Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk, and today we have a very special guest. It is New York Times bestselling author Tammy Hoag, who has a new book out. I think she's got over 30 bestsellers now. It's amazing. Down the Darkest Road is the new one. It is out right now from Dutton, which is also Putnam. She's here to talk about it. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm hanging in there.
It's a loaded question, I know, but there's a lot of people getting sick lately, so I wish you the best.
Yeah, so much. It's the worst time of year for that, you know.
You're going to have to get better for your New Year's Eve party tomorrow.
I think my New Year's Eve party will be me on the couch with my spaniel.
Oh, really? you gotta get yourself better so you can have a party.
Yeah, absolutely.
This new book, I love this book, absolutely. I liked it better than the last book.
Oh, thank you.
I think you're getting better.
I love to hear that. You never know when you're writing, you know, I get so into it and so, you know, too close to the forest to see the trees. So I'm always glad to get that input from readers.
Yeah, there's so much, I hate to say it, but there's more than a little mediocre stuff out there, but your stuff's always good. I can't remember a book of yours I didn't like.
Well, thank you. I love to hear that.
Yeah. Now, is there really a town called Oak Knoll? I see the sign on the cover. Is there really a town?
No. No, that's my, you know, figment of my imagination.
Because I don't think I'd want to live there. There's bad luck that happens there.
Well, yeah. It's now been spread out over a few years, so it's not like every day there's a murder. But, there's been a few bad things happen there in recent history.
I can picture in my head the publishers taking this sign out and putting it by the side of the road and taking a picture and making it look like there really is an Oak Knoll.
Absolutely.
Anything to sell the book, you know. Do you know how many bestsellers you have?
I think we're at 15. I'm not exactly sure.
Do you lose track sometimes?
I do kind of lose track. I've especially lost track of how many books I've written. I think this is like 32 or 33.
What I really like about Down the Darkest Road, the new one, is the main character, and I'm blanking on her name right now.
Lauren,
there it is. What I really like is her introspection in this book. There's a lot of stuff we get to see what's going on in her head a lot in this book, and I really like that. It really makes the character seem more real when you do that.
Yeah, that's what I really wanted to try to put the reader in her place and really try to get some feeling for that kind of angst of a mother with a missing child.
Right. I guess none of us will ever know what that's like. I mean, some of us will, unfortunately. But, I mean,
yeah,
you
hopefully
were
not, yeah.
It's just a hard, to even contemplate losing a child and not knowing where that child is more than any that I could even think of. I mean, I can't even imagine the pain and the suffering that you go through with that, what that would do to you. So hopefully this never happens to anybody. I went on AOL the other day, and there's this proliferation of missing children found dead. And I mean, what is it with society now that we're these things are happening and they're becoming news? It seems like everyone's becoming a news item now.
Well, you know, they do become news items because it is news. It's sensational. It grabs the public attention. Although I saw just the other day the crime statistics were out for the United States, and crime as a whole is actually down. But we have so much access to that, you know, that 24-hour news, and there are so many, venues for news now that they try to keep things out there all the time. And they go, of course, for these kind of cases that are so horrific.
And I guess they saw a lot of newspapers and magazines doing it. That's the
absolutely
main goal.
Absolutely.
Get people to buy, get grab the interest and keep it. Just like when we pick up one of your books, we're as soon as we start reading it, we're like, oh no, here we go, another long night again, reading a Tammy Hoag novel. We're never going to get any sleep tonight, which is exactly what happens. And before you know it, you're 300 pages in, and you're stuck again. which always seems to happen with your books. How do you make that happen? I mean, is there a secret to doing that?
If there's a secret, I don't really know what it is. You know, I mean, for me, the process for me, I want it always to be spellbinding for me as a writer. So I don't, I'm not a person who writes from an outline, so I don't know the next thing that's happening. It has to unfold, practically before my eyes.
Sometimes you'll be writing a chapter and then suddenly realize, oh, I know what's going to happen now, and this is what I'm going to write next. That'll happen.
Yeah,
sometime?
I mean, it's very spontaneous. It's a very organic and spontaneous kind of process for me. So, and with this book, kind of in particular, there were many days when I woke up like towards the end of deadline. And I would wake up and think, oh, my God, I don't know what's going to happen today. And, then somehow magically the muse produces it. And, but I want it to be surprising and shocking and startling for me. So, so that it has to be that way for the reader as well.
Now, you've switched publishing houses over the years. How does that work? Do you take your editor with you when you do that? Do you say, come on and go to this other publishing house? I need you on this one.
No, actually, when you leave a house, you go to another house, and it's a whole new family. And I've only actually done that once in my whole career.
You've only changed once. Wow.
I have only changed once. I was with my first publisher for 20 years, which is, that's like me and Louis L'Amour. Only people have done that.
Right.
It's much more normal for writers to switch houses, several times during their career. I've only done it once.
But you must have gotten really attached to your editor.
Yeah, actually, and I was, very spoiled in that I've only worked with several editors over a span of more than 20 years, which is also unusual. It's very common for writers to work with a number of editors over the course of time. And I was very lucky in that my relationships lasted like blocks of 10 years almost per editor, so...
And
you do get used to somebody, and to move to somebody new is like, oh, I don't know, it's like dating all over again.
But what do editors? I don't even why I'm asking so much about editors. I don't usually ask about editors, but I'm suddenly, your book's edited very well. I mean, I didn't find any mistakes in it. Now, there are some books you look at and there's a word missing or this is, and it really annoys me when that happens. So I wonder how you've done it so smoothly from book to book. I mean, I don't remember any of your books having any mistakes in them.
They're usually very clean. I'm always kind of surprised when I'm reading a book and there's a lot of mistakes because so many eyes see that before it goes to print, And I try to turn it in an exceptionally clean manuscript, so there's not a lot of things to correct when it goes in, but then, I've read it so many times, I see what should be on the page, not necessarily what is on the page, so a word can be missing here and there, but then my editor goes over it several times, the copy editor goes over it, and they're like little, human computers. They catch everything. So I'm always surprised when I see books that have mistakes in them.
You mean they'll even catch if a character's driving in the wrong direction or the something's wrong, something like that is wrong, they'll catch that too?
Absolutely, yeah.
That's pretty cool.
The things they'll catch. And they're, they check your facts and make sure everything is correct. I know in, I think it was Deeper Than the Dead, I had characters going to the Los Angeles airport, and I talked about these columns, these lighted columns, as you drive in onto the property of the airport, and the copy editor caught that had actually not happened yet. And, because I was writing in 1985, the book was set in 1985, and those columns didn't go up for a couple of years after that.
Oh,
but they've been there always, since I'd been going to L.A. They had always been there. But the copy editor caught that.
Now that begs the question: Why are your books set in the 80s? I mean, why did you decide to set them in the 80s?
Well, it was kind accident. Before I wrote Deeper Than the Dead, I had a concept for a book about a character who, as a child, had found out that one of their parents was a murderer. And I was going to write about how that had shaped this person's life, and it would be set in contemporary times. And as I was going through the backstory of that, I decided, no, I really want to tell this story and have that child's point of view. And so that just necessitated that I go back, 20, 25 years, and that put me, smack in the 80s. And then and that gave me a whole new host of problems, because then we had no forensic sciences compared to what we have today. We didn't have DNA testing. They didn't have cell phones. So that presented a whole new challenge.
With the cell phone, I'm constantly amazed by cell phones nowadays. I mean, there's nothing you can't do with a cell phone now. It's staggering. I mean, you can literally. And texting. I mean, it's just amazing what you can. I mean, you don't even have to hear a voice anymore. But anyway.
It is amazing, yeah.
What do you like about Down the Darkest Road? What do you think your fans are going to like about it?
Well, I enjoyed getting into the mind of that mother. And I enjoy that she's an extremely flawed character. And I like that. I like that's very gritty and very real to me. And for me, that really draws me into the situation.
Now, do you have to do research on that? I mean, do you have to find somebody who's been through this? I mean, I hate to say that, but I mean, is that necessary to write as well as you do, or how do you get into the mind?
Now we have so many sources with crime, true crime based television, so you can watch a lot of actual stories of disappearances and whatnot. I have actually spoken with a mother who lost a child, who had a child abducted, and the child was never found. That was many years ago. I spoke with that mother.
I wonder if that one woman ever recovers completely. I wouldn't think you ever would.
No. How can you really?
It's like a part of you was gone.
And you don't know what happened. You don't even have that kind of terrible closure of knowing that the child is dead. Maybe they're not dead. You just don't know. And that was the thing that I really wanted to explore, that, how do you cope with that? And how do you cope with it when you don't feel that you're getting justice, when it might seem to you that is somewhat within reach, but the system is such that they can't even help you. That helplessness and the frustration of that was something I wanted to explore.
Right. You see, and I noticed in some of your books you actually mentioned true life cases. All of a sudden you just come out and talk about a killer, and I'm thinking, she must be a little bit obsessed with serial killers. I mean, you must do a research on serial killers, I should say.
Tons and tons and tons, yes. I can talk serial killers all day long.
Does it ever get you down reading about it so much?
Well, obviously it's a very grim subject, but I come at it from the perspective of wanting to understand the psychology of it and looking at it from the perspective of the police detective. And for them to do what they do, they have learned how to sort of keep it at an emotional arm's length away. And so I've kind of tried to do that myself with doing the research. Otherwise, it would just drive you mad. These are horrible things that happen to people for absolutely no reason. And so that's very difficult.
Yeah, I've recently decided I want to try to interview Ann Rule. I can only imagine the story she has to tell. Somehow, to me, it's fascinating. I think to a lot of people, it's fascinating and yet disturbing at the same time. As long as you keep it in perspective and realize, this is happening and it is disturbing, but, maybe we can learn something from it, too.
Absolutely. And it is still, as much as we see that in the news, just as with the child abduction, it is still an aberration. It's not a common occurrence, but it's something that's so, you know, there's such a morbid fascination when something like that happens that, you know, it really grabs a spotlight.
What I like about Laurel is, you know, I was convinced that she was going to fall in love with a police guy. I mean, I was so convinced. I thought, eventually these two are going to get together, and you really threw me a curve. I don't want to say too much about what does happen, because
she's not in a place where that's even remotely possible. You know, she's so emotionally isolated and so in so much pain that just wasn't ever even a remote possibility for me.
Have you ever been in anything close to as much pain as she's in this book? I mean, have you ever experienced anything close to it?
No, really not. I mean, I've lived a very quiet, normal sort of life, and, you know, I mean, I've lost people in my life, and that would be, you know, the only place I could draw from on that, but, I couldn't even come close to
right.
to what she's been
I guess
through.
When I read that your characters are so real, I start to think, well, maybe she's been through something like this a little bit, or maybe, you know, maybe the author has experienced something.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure you have the same experiences when you read books, and you think, well, maybe the author really has had something like this happen.
Wonder, and I think, you know, that's the mark of an author that's done a really, really good job. You know, I always like in the way I write to method acting. You know, I kind of have to put myself in that character's head and experience those emotions as they're happening and as they're going on the page. So for me, that's, you know, that's the ultimate compliment, that it really comes across like, oh my God, this person has to have been through this.
Right. Do you ever have a lot of trouble writing your books? I'm sure writers have problems all the time, but I mean, you ever have big problems where you just can't get past something? And has that ever happened to you? And did you have any trouble writing Down the Darkest Road?
It's always, it's always a little bit of an exercise in torment. You know, there are wonderful things about writing. There are very difficult things about writing. And because of the way I write and that it has, that it's a very organic process, there's always that sort of edge of the seat nervousness that, you know, what if one day I wake up and there's nothing coming out of my head? Because I don't have that, you know, blueprint to fall back on. It's a very complicated process that way.
And I mean, I can't even imagine how much. I mean, we can all think of stories in our head, and you think of that's a great idea for a story. But I mean, try sitting down writing the whole thing, you know, getting everything sounding good and making the character seem real, and that's very hard.
Not so easy.
I mean, that's why I guess there's a lot of collaborators on books. That's why Tom Clancy has a collaborator now. I guess two heads are better than one. I guess I don't know. I mean,
I can't imagine that. I'm way too much of a control freak to do that. So,
even if somebody came up with say you had a friend writer and they said, "Well, I have this great idea and I know you could help me write it," and you listened to the idea and you liked the idea too, you would still not do it.
No. No, I couldn't do it.
That's interesting, because
no.
I think a lot of writers are like that. They have their own style, and to suddenly have somebody come in and say, "I'm going to work with you," it's kind of like they're barging in on your territory.
Yeah, it is. It's a very good, very territorial feeling towards your characters and stuff. I was, you know, when I see books that are written by like a pair of writers who are a team and they have written, I always wonder how in the world they do that. You know, I don't even know how I would go about that with somebody else, you know, because the process is so personal to me. But, you know, somehow they make that work and it works well for them. But, I'm too much of a lone wolf, I'm afraid.
Right. Now, the relationship between Lauren and her daughter, the one that survived, Leia, right? Isn't her name Leia?
Yeah.
Leia.
Yes.
It's amazing how quickly you forget the names. Their relationship is very strained, too. Should we, you actually start to feel sorry for Leia, because, you know, her mother is distant, and she doesn't have a father. The father, and then that's another unusual thing about this book, the father committing suicide. That's something that you don't see very often in after a child is missing. I wonder how many fathers do that. I mean, would that be a big statistic? Fathers who've committed suicide after their daughters went missing and never found?
Wow, I don't know. That's such a specialized group of people. I don't know. I've certainly known of that happening, you know, and known it's very, very difficult for a couple to stick it out when they've lost a child like that, because everybody deals with that grief in such a different way, and you know, it's not at all uncommon for those couples to end up apart, or you know, one of them becomes an alcoholic, or you know, it's just such a such a terrible strain on an individual that for a couple it's sometimes impossible to overcome that.
I like the way, and some writers are actually, when they have a police detective and they work like long hours, like 12, 13 hours a day, they become these drinkers, these hard drinkers and hard people, you know, and it's like, that's how they get through their day, their awful day, you know, with these awful crimes and arresting people and doing all this stuff that can be very upsetting. You know, they take a drink and you can forget it at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, the statistics are that, you know, rates of alcoholism, suicide, divorce are higher among people in law enforcement, you know, and that's a very tough row to hoe.
That's true. I wonder, as a writer, do you ever get to the point where you need to take a drink while you're writing because you're stressed?
Oh, you better believe it. Absolutely.
But we don't want people to think you drink a lot. Just a little drink here and there.
Because the tension for the writer is like, oh my, you know, because some days these people, these characters, aren't all that cooperative, you know, and they can drive you to distraction. And, it's a strain there.
I wonder, do you have like a blackboard? And I like on the TV show The Closer, where she has this blackboard and writes all the names of the people involved in the case down.
Yeah.
I like the way they do that, and they actually have pictures of the people.
Yeah.
And they'll actually, I mean, do you do that in your mind? I'm not that you have pictures of them, but I mean,
I went through a long period when I was, probably the first 10 years or so of my career where I would actually find photographs. You know, I had a huge clipping folder of people. You know, I had a big folder of men, I had a big folder of photographs of women, and I would literally choose the characters and post them somewhere so I could look at them. I stopped doing that, and I don't know why. It just became unnecessary for me. But I have like a 8-foot long whiteboard, and I do a lot of note making on that, and a lot of, you know, there'll be one board that, or a section of board that, you know, where I'm keeping track of what's actually happened in the case. I'll keep a timeline of the crime, just like a homicide investigator would do, so that you can keep everything straight and keep, you know, here's a lead, here's a suspect. You know, here's how you followed this out to see if this was plausible or if this person had an alibi. So I do that actually, you know, in my own little office as well.
Right. I'm sure it helps. I just wonder a lot of times, you know, there's so many, I read books and, you know, sometimes you can tell where it's going, but I never have that problem with you. I'm always surprised by your books. I'm always surprised by what happens at the end. And just when I think I know what's going on, I don't, and I like that. And it's so easy to fall into the trap of just having a regular investigation. Now, everybody, this person gets suspected. Like on TV, when it's an hour show, and in a half hour they think they have the killer. You know they haven't got the killer if there's a half hour show.
Right.
Left. So.
Right.
I mean, but sometimes with a book, you can actually, you know, you can actually make that person the killer at the end, and then surprise people the other way too. So there's. But you never want a book to be standard. You never want it to be, oh, I've read this kind of book before, and I know how it's going to turn out. But that's difficult to do. That's not easy to do. I mean, it's like, it's constant.
It's not.
It's constant. You know, how do I surprise my reader? So they're not saying, oh, what a dumb ending, and close the book and be frustrated and may never open your books again.
Yeah, I never want that to happen, and that's why, you know, it needs to be a surprise for me as I'm going through. You know, there have to be a lot of surprises to me. If it's surprising to me, and it better be surprising to the reader. Now, every once in a while, I'll have somebody who, you know, they want to make themselves appear like they're masterminds. Oh, well, of course, I figured it out on page 152, and I always say, well, you're a lot smarter than I am, because I didn't figure it out in page, you know, until page 425.
Right. They're right, they're right.
Some kind of genius.
Yeah, there are some really perceptive readers, and I know some of them, and they'll say, well, I knew it on page 20, and I think, well, how did you know on page 20?
Yeah.
How could you possibly know right away who the killer was? And for some reason, I think reading a lot, sometimes you pick up little things that writers might have. Now, I've never done that with you.
You know, but there might be, you know, people fall into patterns, you know, I'm sure.
I find it.
You know, that's why I try not to fall into a pattern, so people are surprised.
The question to ask them is, you know, what gave it away? That's what I'd like to know. What exactly gave it away? Now, I've never really asked them that. They just kind of were surprised, and I think, oh, well, maybe they did, maybe they didn't, maybe they were just saying that to brag.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Because the new Robert Ellis book, I was just talking to Robert Ellis a few weeks ago, and he told me, I made sure that nobody could figure out that ending before the ending. And he said, there's no way you can figure out that ending. And I consider that a challenge. Now, if he told me that before I read the book, I would have definitely tried to figure it out. But I find that fascinating. I mean, that an author can do that for readers. I mean,
I usually don't know the ending, you know, until I get to the ending, or I'll go in with an agenda and think I know who the killer is, but you know, part way through the book, then I've become bored with that idea. I'm like, oh, well, this is no fun. I know who the killer is. That can't be who it is. It must be somebody else. And, right. You know, then things will take a twist and a turn. And, I just can't stand to be bored as a writer. So I don't want to know well in advance.
Well, that puts a lot of pressure on you to do it the right way, to do it the way you want it and the way your readers want it. Obviously, that's one of the things you would say that you think the readers will like about this book is the surprise ending. And I agree that there is a huge surprise ending, and it makes the book even more good. More good, that doesn't sound quite right. It makes it better. I'm glad I'm not a writer. I need an editor for sure. My thoughts are there, but I don't always say the right word. Do you ever have that problem?
Oh, absolutely, of course.
But when you think about, I mean, your books are usually about 400 pages. I mean, that's a lot to say for one book. And I always think to myself, wow, how does a writer get from one point to another? I mean, there's just so much involved. You know, what are the characters real enough? Are the situations real enough? Is there a surprise? Are there surprises along the way? I mean, you look at Jeffrey.
You look at
the pace. Yeah, the pace is extremely important. I mean, if you're reading a book and somebody says, I can't put it down, I mean, that's the ultimate compliment that somebody would say that.
Absolutely.
Doesn't necessarily mean it's the greatest book in the world, because there's some of James Patterson's books I can't put down, but that doesn't make them great books. But you know, you wonder, you know, the secret behind it. I mean, how that is done, and how as a writer you get better at that as you go along. I mean, you have to, because you have to constantly think up surprise endings.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, Agatha Christie had, I don't know how many novels, 80 novels, and she had to come up with a surprise ending each time. But she would actually have her characters be completely different from what you thought. Like, you thought somebody was a carpenter, and they turned out to be a policeman or something. You know, there's all these little surprises at the end that she was able to pull off.
Right.
And it's got to seem real. You can't do the trick where you bring the killer into the plot in the very last chapter and decide he's the killer and that's it, and nobody even knew he existed
now,
before.
Oh my goodness, now readers will have your head on a platter for that. They really, you have to play fair. You do have to play fair. It can't be such a curveball that, you know, there was just no possible way of even having a hint of somebody being a suspect. You know, that's just really, it's like cheating. You know, it feels like cheating.
Right. What are you most grateful for as a writer?
That the ideas keep coming and that people continue to find them interesting and engaging.
I guess we should talk about Down the Darkest Road, the actual plot, because we really haven't talked about it a little bit. Why don't you explain the plot to people who haven't read it, just so we can get them even more interested than they already are.
Sure. Well, 4 years prior to the beginning of the book, Lauren Lawton's eldest daughter, Leslie, was abducted. They have never found her. They don't know if she's alive or dead. A lot of people presume she is dead, but they have no body to prove that. Lauren and, in fact, the police in Santa Barbara believe they know who the abductor is, but they do not have enough physical evidence to do anything about it. They can't charge him with anything. They have one teeny tiny piece of blood evidence, but this book is set in 1990, and at that time, to test that evidence would be to destroy the evidence, and with no guarantee of getting information out of it. The sample is too small. This is predating the technology we have today, where samples can be multiplied in the laboratory and you can have more to work with and you can get more information from them. 1990, they weren't able to do that. So they have this tantalizing little piece of evidence. They know the technology is coming, but they have to wait for the technology to come to them. And it just becomes an unbearable frustration for this mother, who needs to have some sort of resolution. And it's Lauren and her daughter, Leah, who is now turning the same age as the daughter who was abducted. They move to Oak Knoll and come to find out that the suspected abductor has also moved to Oak Knoll. And then we have a cat and mouse game of stalking going on as Lauren tries to get some kind of resolution for this.
Right, and that's a really good outline of the book. I like that. And I'm sure you're working on another book now, but I mean, it's hard sometimes when you're talking about the current book. You're already writing your next book, I'm sure. So
I'm just getting started. I haven't actually started, and I have such a crazy schedule that Down the Darkest Road, I finished that book in September. So it's still quite fresh for me.
Because oh, really?
It really wasn't that long ago. Yeah, which is totally abnormal. Most books are in about, 9 months to a year ahead of publication. But my life is different.
Right.
So it's still very fresh in my mind.
And the readers out there are wondering, what in the world did she do? What besides writing? I mean, there's got to be. I know you. Do you still ride horses?
I do, yeah. That's my other career. I train and show horses in the Olympic discipline of dressage. So that's half of my day is spent doing that, and half of my day is spent as a writer.
Now, do you actually own any horses yourself?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I have now. I think I'm down to five. I had eight for a long time, and I think I'm down to five now.
Wow, I didn't realize you had five horses. I don't know if we've talked about that before. I know we talked with you last year, and I don't remember bringing that up before, but it's interesting. I mean, as a fan, you always wonder, what's the writer do when he's not writing? I mean, there's got to be...
Right.
Well, what would we see if we walked into your house right now, besides you with your dogs on the sofa?
Well, right now, because I have just moved from one house to another, you would see boxes to the rafters. It's quite a mess. I spent a lot of time living half the year on the West Coast in Los Angeles and half the year in Florida, and so I had a small home in Florida. I had a large home in California. I've now consolidated everything in Florida, and so I'm now seeing things I haven't seen in years. You know, things that have been packed away and storage and whatnot. So it's quite chaotic at the moment.
Right, I can imagine. Wow, I didn't realize you had two houses. That's good. Now, is there one house you like to write in more than the other, or are they both conducive to writing? Or is there a certain atmosphere you need for writing?
Well, I need my little den. I need my little lair, you know, that I go into, and you know, wherever I am living, I've always got a space that's what I do. You know, it's totally devoted to the work. And so now in this new house, I've got a new office that I'm so excited to, you know, settle in and get all my reference books and all my research and all my, you know, everything arranged the way I want it. And I'll just live in that little office for many weeks at a time, practically, you know. So I have everything I need in there. You know, I've got television, I've got my stereo, I've got a refrigerator in there, you know. So when the deadline comes, I, you know, just have to kind of crawl from that room to the bed and back, you know.
Right, exactly. I wonder, and I think it's an Entertainment Weekly where they actually show the space of writers. I know they did Patricia Cornwell at one point. I think they did Sarah Paretsky. They actually show you where they write. So it shows you their holes.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. And you think, you see all the notes all over the place, and you think, oh my gosh, and that they turn that stuff into a book?
I know. Yeah, it looks totally mad. And then the things that, especially crime writers, you accumulate these odd things that other people don't have in their libraries. You know, like I have what's called a rape kit in my office. You know, that a sex crimes detective gave me, which is the box where they have everything for collecting the evidence. You know, for a rape. You know, that's sitting on my shelf. I've got a bullet, that has actually been shot out of a gun. I have, you know, here's the result of what comes out of the end of the gun, and it's this nasty, wicked, twisted, horrible little piece of copper that I keep that right on my desk all the time, and because I'll pick that up and I'll look at it and I'll think about, you know, the pain and the damage that something like that does, and you know, that just it's important, I think, for me anyway, because I do write a pretty graphic book. You know, I don't pull any punches with the violence and stuff, and there's no, you know, there's no, like, television kind of bang bang, and there's no blood. It's a violent, nasty thing. So, you know, to have that and to pick that up and think, oh, yeah, this is crime, you know, right here in this little, you know, this is hatred, this is malice, this is... you know, somebody's disillusionment all in this little nasty twisted piece of metal. So I keep things like that.
Right. Do readers ever complain that you're too graphic? I mean, I don't care. I like them. I've never had a problem thinking they're too graphic, but do you ever get complaints like tone it down at all?
No, not really. I mean, every once in a while, I'll find a reader who's like, oh, you know, that's too scary for me, or you know, and that's fine, you know, because that's not for everybody, you know. It's that's why we have so many different genres. You know, this is something for everyone's taste, and not everyone wants to really.
But you enjoy writing.
I do. I love what I do. That's the kind of book I like. That's the kind of story I really like to tell. I feel like when I'm writing violence, it should be shocking. It should be terrible. It's a terrible thing. You know, I don't ever want to gloss over how horrible that is.
But you don't glorify the violence, though. I mean, there's
no,
a difference.
No.
I mean, there are some authors that really go. I mean, when you look at Stephen King's writing, some of his writing, I mean, it's just he describes in detail how people are bleeding and gushing
and
I mean, and it's a little over the top. I mean, let's face it, we all know Stephen King's been over the top during his career, but. I mean, I still enjoy reading, but there are definitely moments in his books where I say, "Oh my gosh, Stephen, you got to stop." But we never. I don't ever remember feeling that way about your books, that they were that graphic, because you know you don't describe it.
I don't want it to be gratuitous, but I want it to be real.
It's like I think of acting. You know, acting sometimes if it's too much, if you act too much over the top, it doesn't come off as real.
Right.
And right. if it's too obvious that you're acting, you know, it's not a believable character to me. And I get really upset when that happens, when a performance is like phoned in, you know, or
it really takes you out of the moment. Really, it's jarring.
But I mean, when I think about writers, when I pick up a book, I want to be able to know these characters. I want to feel like I could be friend. I mean, I could know who these people are. I want to know what's in their head. I want to know how they feel. I want to know everything about them. And you know, and some writers don't do that. And then you feel like they're like cardboard characters. I mean, and you don't remember them from book to book because they're not real to you.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, for me, the character is what it's really all about, the psychology of the character, and really, really making that person three-dimensional and real is, that's the heart of it for me.
Now, this is your third book with Oaknall, or is it?
Yes.
Okay, so are you done with Oaknall, or are there going to be more?
No, there's definitely going to be more, which is surprising to me because I'm not by nature a person who writes a series or reads a series. I tend to get bored really easily, and so I always want to do something different.
So are there some characters in this book that will be in your next book?
No, I am taking a break in the next book. I'm going back to my homicide detectives in Minneapolis because I haven't visited them in many years.
Oh.
And I would like to go back and explore those characters a little more. And, you know, sort of just take a little vacation.
You miss them.
Yeah, I do. I miss them. I'm like, whatever happened, you know. I think I didn't go back to them for a while because I just had this terrible feeling that Sam Kovacs' romance didn't work out in the last book. I'm like, I think that didn't end well for him. And I didn't want to go back to that because I didn't want to face that.
Well, is that hard because
Is
it hard because you haven't written in so many, I mean, how many years has it been since you wrote one of those books?
It's been quite a long time ago. Prior Bad Acts was the last book with Kovac and Liska, and that's been, got to be 5 or 6 years ago now.
Right. So you're a little rusty with your characters, but obviously you have records of all that, so you know it's easy to pick up where left off.
Yeah, and they stay, you know, they kind of stay in the back of my mind all the time, you know, because they're so real, and they, you know, they're like old friends, you know, so you don't really forget them. They're still back there.
Right. Now, do you already have a story for the next book? I mean, you already know what you're going to write about. I don't want you to give it away or anything. If I know you.
Yeah, I do actually. It's a Jane Doe murder investigation. Which is something I haven't done before, and I find that very interesting.
So how does that work? You just wake up in the middle of the night and you say, I'm going to write a book about a Jane Doe investigation. Does it just sort of, you just have the sudden urge, like we have urges to like do hobbies and stuff, like stamp collecting?
Kind of, yeah. Kind of. And, you know, and I study so many true crimes that so many, you know, I see so much all the time of, you know, interesting cases where this happened or that happened, and I'll think, what if these characters were plugged into that situation? What would happen? What if this person was the victim? How did they come to be a victim? How did, you know, what in their lives led them to do that? You know, so there's just this constant inspiration that way, you know, and then these things just kind of percolate in the mind until I'm like, I want to explore that situation or that crime.
I wonder if you watch these true crime programs and the ones that are unsolved and you think, I know who did it. Does that ever happen to you?
Sometimes, sure. Yeah, sometimes, you know, I really think, you know, I like that guy for the killer, but they don't have enough against, you know, they don't have any physical evidence or whatever. But, you know, I mean, you never get the complete story, because there's no way to tell, you know, an entire homicide investigation. You don't know all the nuances of the interviews and so on.
So do you know yet how many Oaknall books there are going to be? I mean, will it be 12? Will it be 20? Do you know?
I really don't know, because now, you know, in Down the Darkest Road, I've introduced a new character in Danny Tanner, the detective from Santa Barbara, and, you know, I didn't know she was going to be in that book. She just up and there she was, And now I'm like, oh, I'm really interested in her, and I'm interested in her backstory, and, you know, maybe there's going to be a book about an investigation that is her investigation in Santa Barbara, and, you know, the people from Oak, the, you know, detectives from Oakville become involved in that case somehow, or, you know, Vince Leone, who was a big focus in Deeper Than the Dead. I know Vince. You know, Vince now works as a consultant. He was an FBI profiler. He was one of the pioneers of profiling. He now works as an independent consultant to law enforcement agencies all over the world. Well, you know, there's so many possibilities of things that Vince can become involved in. And, you know, I have a very strong sense of what's going to happen with him, and that there's going to be another book with Vince as the focus as he investigates a crime not in Oak Knoll. You know, so there are a lot of possibilities. I've become very attached to those characters, you know, and I like in this series that it's not, the focal point is not always a particular character. You know, it's not like there's one detective and every book is about him. There's, you know, in Deeper Than the Dead, it was Anne Leone, you know, who was a fifth grade teacher. You know, she was really the focus of that story. And then, you know, in the next book, the murder investigation was about somebody you'd never seen before, you know, and, you know, so it's doesn't become old or stale for me because there are constantly new influences and the focus is always on somebody different.
It must be cool to know that, I mean, you suddenly write a character and you suddenly realize, I like this character. I want to do more with this character. I want to write a whole book about this character and bring out everything in and maybe add some humor, too. I mean, humor is important, too. I mean,
absolutely.
And it to be fun. I mean, writing stuff that's funny, you know, sometimes that's hard work, too. I mean, you have to think of jokes.
Oh, that's very hard work. Yeah, very few people can write comedy successfully.
It's like,
that was how I started my career, was writing romantic comedy. And the reason I went in that direction was because I knew so few people could pull that off.
I think sometimes I could be a stand-up comedian, because I always have
absolutely.
These, I know I can make people laugh, but I don't know if I could do it consistently. I don't know that I could.
Yeah.
I mean, how many jokes do you have to come up with for one stand-up routine? You'd have to come up with hundreds and hundreds.
Oh, yeah.
And you have to keep, you know, thinking up. You can't keep repeating yourself. And you as a writer are going to say, because you can't repeat yourself either. Or people will say, well, you did that before. You did that in 5 books ago, and I remember that.
Yes.
And they remember.
Yeah, that people do that. You know?
They do. And I can imagine the emails you get. You know, you idiot, why did you repeat yourself? I mean, it's got to be funny. It's got to be interesting to get the fan mail that you get. I'm sure you get a lot of it, but I mean, I can only imagine what they say to you. You know, bring that character back. How dare you kill that character?
Yeah. Oh yeah, you have to be careful who you off in a book.
I mean, you can imagine.
I was a really popular character one time, and people were just like, "How could you do that?"
It just killed me. And Karen Slaughter got away with it. She killed her main character in one of her books, and people still haven't forgiven her for it.
Yeah.
I'm surprised she hasn't had rocks thrown to her windows, you know. It's like,
yeah.
But I mean, but she got.
That's why we live in anonymity. You know?
But you know, it somehow. I mean, you read the books. And, his name's Jeffrey, I think, and you read the books, and you're like, I really miss Jeffrey. And you do. You feel this really heavy sadness that he's gone. What would he be like if he were around? So, but at the same time, it's got to be realistic.
Right. And, you know, and I mean, that is a part of life, you know. People come in and out of your life, and you miss them, or you hate them, or you love them, or, you know, or a combination of all of those things. And, you know, I think that keeps you invested as a reader. It keeps you invested in that series.
But I wonder, it brings a thought to my mind that I've never asked before. Have you ever had a character that you wrote, and then all of a sudden you didn't like the character, and you decided, I'm just going to kill him off? has that ever happened to you?
Not as a protagonist. I mean, I have had a couple of main characters that I had very adversarial relationship with during the course of the writing, and I'd be like, you know, he's just such a jerk.
That's right.
But I didn't kill him. The secondary characters, that happens all the time. You know, somebody will become sudden, you know, I'm like, I'm bored at a certain point, and, you know, I'm like stuck or something at a certain point in the story. I remember years ago I was working on a book, and, yeah, there's always there's a certain ebb and flow to the writing of a book, and there's usually a place where you will kind of tend to get stuck a little bit, mm-hmm. You know, once you get a certain way into the book. At least that happens for me and for a lot of people I know. Mm-hmm. And I remember having a conversation with another writer friend, and I'm like, you know, I'm kind of bored, I'm a little not happy, I don't know, you know, now I've got this guy, and I don't know what to do, she's like, well, what, just kill him, and I'm like, yeah, I think I might have to kill him, you know, and then I later came to find out that because of some circumstances of a neighbor of mine, my phone was tapped. And the FBI was literally listening to my phone call, and I'm talking about how I'm really bored with this guy. I think I'm going to kill him.
Oh, really?
So that became, yes.
How interesting. Recently I've been talking to a woman. She's in England, and you know what? I don't know her all that well, but I know she's extremely opinionated about books, and now I'm afraid to ask her about books because I'll say to her, well, what's the new Elizabeth George look like, or what do you think of that? And she'll tell me exactly what she thinks.
Oh, no.
But she's extremely critical. I mean, I can only imagine what she'd do with some of these books that I've read. Like, how could you read that garbage, you know? But she'll say to me, they're a little boring lately, or they're not, I don't like the way they do this, and I mean, she'll pick apart every little thing in a book, and you know what, that can ruin, I don't like people like that sometimes,
it's your fun, you know, I mean,
right,
it's an individual experience, you know,
it is, but when you like a book and somebody tears it apart, it's not a very fun feeling.
No, not at all.
And, you know, but I think there's a point where you become too critical. But I've known people like that, where they just end up being so critical of everything that you wonder, what do you like? What could you possibly like?
Yeah. And why would they continue to, they seemingly get no joy from the process. So,
right. And you know, it's scary. It's like, you're going to ruin reading for everybody. No, shut up.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it's. But anyway, I don't know what made me think of that, but just the idea that when we were talking about how hard it is to come up with these ideas and know exactly where a book's going and know exactly what to do has got to be very difficult. Well, if the way I see it, you did it really well in Down the Darkest Road, and I liked it.
Well, thank you.
I mean, I got started on your books from Night's End and Guilty of Sin, which to me are two fantastic books. Anybody out there who hasn't read them, you need to go back and read them. They're just, I remember when they did a miniseries with Valerie Bertinelli.
Yes.
Did you meet her, by the way, when they were doing that?
I did. I actually went on set for a couple of days, and it was a fun experience. You know, those things don't always work out the way writers would like for them to, but just for me, it was a very fun experience. And even more enjoyable to me is that it still airs. You know, it's now 10 years. It's more than 10 years since that aired. I think it aired in 1997 or 98. And it still airs on cable.
What?
You know, so that's so much fun.
I remember when I first read Night's End, and then it ends really right literally on a cliffhanger. And I thought, oh, now I got to get the next book. I mean, and it's such a terrific two-book series. I mean, I hope you write a book like that again and do that again, because I love the way you did that. I think it's incredibly great. There was something about those two books that just really resonated. I still think about my reading experience when I read those all these years.
Oh, that's a big compliment. Yeah. And that I actually did. I took some flack for that, the way that Night's End ended, because you got a resolution, but you didn't get an entire resolution.
Right.
And I did. You know, a lot of readers really loved it, and then there was a whole set of readers that were so angry with me because it wasn't all tied up in a nice, neat bow. And my feeling was, you know, you don't always get a nice, neat, tidy ending in life, and you I don't think it's necessary that you get an entirely tidy ending in fiction either. You know, it's that's part of the experience. So, and I'm very much enjoyed writing it that way, you know, and then coming back, and eventually you get the whole resolution.
Right.
But to me, you could have read Night Sins, that could have been the end of it, and you just never did know. You know, I mean, let's look at, you know, Hannibal Lecter got away. You know,
right.
I mean, so that's, you know, that was part of that, the experience of reading that book, was like, oh my God, he got away. You know?
Is Valerie as nice as she seems? I think I'm in love with Valerie Bertinelli.
She's super nice. Really, a very nice, down-to-earth kind of person.
I love watching her expressions. I still watch her on Hot in Cleveland, and she has the most wonderful expressions on her face.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something about the way she delivers lines. And it, when you look at comedy to me is very, very hard because... You look at Lucille Ball with those expressions, and you think, what a genius that is, to be able to express everything with that face.
And that's a gift. That's such a talent.
But, I mean, I'm glad she was nice. And she seems like a very, very personable person. And she never looks any older, either.
No, she doesn't. Isn't that's very frustrating to women everywhere. She doesn't seem to age.
And
she really nailed that character, too. I mean, she really nailed that character.
Now, I know TNT...
I was so pleased.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Now, TNT's been doing a lot of author books. Have they approached you about doing any of your novels for television?
Yeah, we've got some talking going on now. I'm not exactly sure. You know, my film agent has presented a selection of things, you know, different books, different characters, and you know, so far I haven't really heard anything back yet. If they're interested or not interested, or is Hollywood such a weird and fickle place? You know, you really have to hit the right person at the right moment with the big, perfect, you know, whatever their definition of that it may be. So, you know, there's always hope. I mean, it's very encouraging to see so much fiction now coming to the small screen,
right,
and not the big screen. You know, it's but that's a very weird and different world.
Yeah, I'm very happy for Lisa Scottolini, one of my friends, and they're doing Devil's Corner. They're going to make that into a movie.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's exciting for her, and it's exciting for the fans to see something that they've read come, you know, you see it on TV, you see all the characters come to life.
Right.
And it's such a wonderful thing. Do you ever get fan mail from famous people that read your books?
Yes, actually, I have had quite a bit of mail from the first President Bush and Mrs. Bush.
Really?
They're among my fans. So it's been
that's
probably the most notable.
I would never have guessed that. He wouldn't have been my first guess.
You kind of an image of him as a politician and who he must be, and but his reading tastes are quite varied, and
that's great.
So yeah, he would be the most notable, I would say.
Right. Well, we've talked for the whole hour. Boy, we're just about out of time. It's been a wonderful thing again. I always enjoy talking to you, Tammy, and I love this book.
Always so much fun. I'm so glad to be able to.
The new book again is called Down the Darkest Road. It's just out from Putnam in all your bookstores now. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.